Thanks again to everyone that's read, participating in the meeting. I take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Warm welcome to any visitors with us this evening, and a massive welcome to anyone that might be new to NA. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. And for those that might not be aware, we are a speaker meeting tonight, and we have the recording on because we do record our speakers, and we will put them on the on our speaker library, information of for which would be forthcoming towards the end of the meeting, I feel sure, from our wonderful GSR. So it falls on me to invite to introduce our speaker this evening. I have to say, I'm absolutely delighted this gentleman agreed at short notice to come along and share with us tonight. He kind of came into our meetings a little while ago, and it actually feels like he's been here forever. And I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean that in a sense that, he's become a part of and has got a very gentle, loving, and kind way of carrying the message, which I really appreciate and definitely relate to. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce to Keith. He's just celebrated a major milestone in his recovery this week. And he's going to share his experience, strength, and hope journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous for 40, 45 minutes, or as much long as he's comfortable with. So, Keith, please, sir, the floor is yours. Please jump in and share with us. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Dave.
Steve.
I'm Keith. I'm recovering from addiction. My clean date's 4th of
Oh,
July,
hi,
2000.
Keith. Hi,
Hi,
Keith.
everybody. So, yeah, I just celebrated 24 years. So, I didn't really know what to talk about today. And so that's usually the case for me. And so I just pray because, and I ask my higher power to use me as a vehicle for its intelligence. And, and I do that because that's what I was taught to do when I didn't know what to do, and which is most of the time. And, that's one of the kind of fundamental principles of Narcotics Anonymous, that a higher power works through us in a lot of different ways. But one of those ways is to carry the message, because I have a 12 step, and the 12 step tells me that, that's kind of my job now, to carry the message to the addict that still suffers and practice these principles in all my affairs. But, it didn't begin with that. It began with the first step. I was fortunate. I didn't have any problem finding a sponsor when I first got clean. I can't remember exactly how long it was between, my first day clean and when I started the first step. It's been too long. I just can't remember. But what I do remember is that, it's the summer of 2000, and the workbook, the flat book's only been out for a couple of years. And people were just starting to use it, and the old timers were starting to take each other through it. Because there's an idea that not everyone agrees with, but a lot of old timers do, which is this, that I'm not going to give a sponsee an assignment that I haven't done. And there's a lot of people that believe that stick to that idea. And that's why they were taking each other through the workbook, because nobody had gone through it before. And my sponsor had gone through it. And so that's what he gave me. He said, go get one of these. And so I got one. And I remember looking at the first step, and there's like, I don't know, 63, 64 questions, or maybe 65. I forget. I haven't counted them lately. There's a lot of questions. And I felt overwhelmed. I'm like, are you kidding me? I don't know how to do this. And I can't remember exactly how long it was. I think it was maybe a month, maybe 5 weeks before he told me to go ahead and start. Because there is the step before the steps. And that step is about becoming a part of, going to meetings every day, doing 90 and 90, finding, maybe getting lucky and finding a home group and a sponsor. That's the step before the steps. Trying to begin the process of finding our place in the fellowship. And I'm a big proponent of doing work prior to the steps. Because the steps are in chapter 4 for a reason. That's why we have chapters 1, 2, and 3 before. And we're supposed to work 1, 2, and 3 in some fashion. prior to starting the steps. Now, that's not what my sponsor had me doing, but in subsequent years, when I sponsor someone, that's what I have them do, because I think that's important. So I think we need a foundation in the fellowship before we start working the steps. Because for me, that first set of steps was like taking a knife and gutting me. It just ripped me wide open. And I remember, when I started the first step, that first part of the workbook is really about the disease of addiction. And the questions are about the disease of addiction. And one of those questions is about, what is it like when I'm in a place of obsession? And I remember I struggled with that question because I was always in a place of obsession. So it didn't seem different to me. I was always like that. And it took me a while to understand what the question was really trying to get to. And then it became clear to me, when I'm obsessed with something, it's like being on fire. It's just being on fire. And I can't, and I don't have the ability to put the fire out. That's what it's like for me, be in a place of obsession. And it doesn't matter whether the obsession is over people, places, or things. It doesn't matter. It's just on fire. And I remember, right after that, it comes to that section on denial. And I had no idea what denial was. I had heard the word, and I had a dictionary, so I looked it up. But I really, there was no way that I could understand, being new in the program, the importance of denial and how I had very much lived most of my life in a state of denial. And I had no idea how depth, the depths of that denial. And it would take many years and multiple sets of steps for that denial to be really, truly broken through. It's not something that happens overnight. And it's because it's like a cake. It's got layer after layer after layer after layer. And I didn't know that at the time. So I remember my sponsor saying, just focus on, your denial about being an addict. And I said, okay, because I didn't see myself as an addict. Like many people, I thought addicts were homeless. I wasn't homeless. I thought addicts went to jail, and I had spent a few nights in jail, but that's it. So I had a wrong idea in my head about what an addict was. Because, where I grew up, everybody was loaded in my family. Everybody got loaded one way or another, one drug or another. So it didn't seem unusual to me. And as I went through my young life, all the people that I ran around with, they got loaded. And I didn't, and I remember the first time I started to get this idea that maybe there's something different about me was in college, because I had a roommate, and he would, we would get high, and then he would go to bed because he had class or work the next morning. I'm like, what? You're going to bed with, we've got dope. Why would you leave? And I couldn't understand why someone would leave when there's dope on the table. I couldn't get my mind around it, and I remember thinking back that that was one of the first times that maybe there was a hint that there was something different about me. And so that denial, I was in denial about so many things. And I remember really struggling with that section on denial. Especially, I think there's a question about, have I blamed others for my behavior? Oh boy, did I blame others. I mean, that was a big part of how I operated. I have a friend, she calls it Keith's tale of woe. And she said that's when she always knows when I'm doing really well, and I no longer have a tale of woe. But in active addiction, I was one big long tale of woe, and my tale of woe was very useful to manipulate other people. Well, I mean, let's face it, that's why we have tales of woe, so we can manipulate other people, and it was very successful. But when I got into recovery and I was in the first step, my tale of woe was not very useful. And I did not want to admit that I blamed other people for my own behavior, but I did. I struggled writing about denial. I remember my sponsor made me go back and rewrite a few things. And I got to tell you, I was not happy about that. You know, and then you start confronting this idea of hitting bottom, despair, isolation. You know, I didn't think that I had a bottom. I really didn't. I didn't have a conception of what that might have been. Now, it wasn't until later in my recovery that I looked back on my life experience and I saw where the bottom actually was. My bottom happened a decade before I got clean. You know, that place, as I understand it, you know, that place of just abject despair. And somehow that place of despair was not enough, you know, to get me to go to a program. I mean, I knew 12-step programs existed. You know, I grew up with people that went to AA, but I still didn't see, you know, any purpose for me to do that. Even though when I had been younger, I'd had a conversation with a doctor about, you know, abuse of substances, but I just kind of, you know, tucked that conversation away and forgot all about it. You know, that's part of that denial. My denial is very skillful. Anyway, you know, during this period, I'm going to at least a meeting a day, usually more. We had the clubhouse that we had back then was right next to this Asian grocery store, so people would always go get buckets, you know, little cups of ramen and stuff. And but yeah, I would usually go 10, 12 meetings a week because I wasn't working, I had nothing else to do, and there was free coffee and often there was food. And so I just started hanging out there, you know, and I couldn't sleep. I don't know about you guys, but when I was in my first step, the first time, I couldn't sleep. And so we had a morning meeting, like a 7 a.m. meeting. So I'd go to the 7 a.m. meeting and I'd maybe stay for the nooner and then go home, take a nap, and then come back. It was very common for me. I went to a lot of meetings. And I felt like being in the meeting was a safe place because I didn't feel safe in the world. And that's one of the things that starts to happen. As we get clean and start working the steps, you know, some of our actual feelings start to surface. And for me, one of those feelings was this deep sense of not being safe in the world. And that would turn out to be one of the reasons, you know, that I used because I didn't feel, you know, safe in the world. And for me, that made it would seem like that would be easy to confront powerlessness because I didn't feel safe, but it turns out it was the exact opposite. When I had to start writing about powerlessness and stop and talking to my sponsor about it, I had no idea what you guys were fucking talking about. Powerless. Well, I just didn't understand. I couldn't get my mind around that concept because it had been my experience that, you know, that through a long list of addictive behaviors that I could have an impact on things. You know, I could talk my way out of a ticket, or I could talk my way out of getting fired, or I could talk my way into the next job, you know. And so I didn't feel powerlessness. I didn't feel powerless. I thought that I had power. But that's just part of the delusion of the disease of addiction. That's just part of the arrogance of the disease of addiction. But I did not know that yet because I'm just in my first step. I don't know crap. All I know is that every day that goes on, I start to hurt more, not less, more. And I wasn't real keen, you know, on that. And, you know, and I thought for a while, I remember that I had this really stupid thought that I thought, you know, when I was starting to think about and write about unmanageability, that being clean was actually causing my unmanageability. That's what an outrageous idea, but it made sense at the time. And of course, my life was horribly unmanageable, you know, and it was at this point that my sponsor had me do a job inventory. And some of you may have heard me talk about this in the past. And because he asked me, well, what part of your life has displayed the greatest amount of unmanageability? And I said, well, probably work. And so he made me do an inventory. My sponsor was very big on inventories, and you didn't have to wait till you were in the fourth step to use the inventory tool and use that process. And as I've said before, I had 63 jobs from the time I was paid jobs from the time I was 15 to 42, 63 jobs, which is, outrageous. And it's all because of unmanageability and inability to interact with other people in a reasonable way. And so by the time I got done writing about unmanageability, because that's in the workbook, that's a huge section. There's a bunch of questions. And I remember feeling kind of exhausted. And I think I actually took a week or so, off. And at some point, my sponsor started talking to me about reservations, and then I think there's a section in the workbook on reservations. And I was full of reservations. I had a long list. And so again, there's questions to write, but my sponsor likes the inventory process. So he made me inventory them and then answer the questions. And that gave me a kind of a deeper understanding, I think, of my own reservations. I don't think that I truly got to all of them. I think that reservations lay in wait secretly, covered up by layers of denial, and they're in there. And there's no way we can get to them all in that first set of steps. It takes more sets of steps to get to them all. And that's just, kind of the way it is. And then I think, and then when you go into the workbook, you start talking about surrender. I had the same kind of antiquated idea that all of us do, surrender, hands up in the air. Yes, don't shoot, officer, right? That's what surrender means. Or, growing up in America, watching Western on television, seeing people surrender, or war movies. I had no idea about spiritual surrender. I mean, I that, you know, because at that point, I had something like a higher power. It really wasn't a higher power. It's more like a spiritual practice, but it wasn't mine. I had borrowed it from someone else. And it was more like, come to think, when I look at it now, I think it was more like a talking point. It wasn't a real thing. It was just a talking point. But I didn't know that at the time. And I would find out more about that later in subsequent steps. And I think, as I recall, there's a really long section in the workbook about spiritual principles. Because that in the first step is where we first get, really introduced to spiritual principles in a way where we have to actually have to start interacting with them. Because there's a lot of questions, and honestly, open-mindedness and willingness are there. And I was just, I had didn't have a service position yet. So by this time, it's, getting into the fall, and so I probably June, July, August, and September. And I didn't have a service position yet, and I didn't really understand why I needed a service position. I'd gotten high for a long time. The detox doesn't just end after a few days of, abdominal pain. The detox lasts goes on for a long time. We have to detox our brain. And that doesn't happen overnight. But someplace in there, I got enough sense that to do that work. And I remember there was an old timer. He's still with us. He's one of the guys that, well, he's the guy that got in his 1968 Nova and drove to California and brought back the first edition of the basic text in the trunk of his car. He's that guy. Every place, every area has that guy, one guy who did that. And sometimes it's a woman. And so I remember him telling me that that the first step is not an intellectual experience. That in order to have a successful first step experience, it has to be emotional, psychological, spiritual. That if you did your first step completely in your brain, then you would not understand the first step. That you had to do it in a way where you could start feeling it in your body. And so I tried to incorporate that understanding in my writing, because I sure as hell didn't want to have to do this over again. And in the end, I remember, going over the first step with my sponsor, and in the end, he said, "You get it. You get the first step." I'm like, "Oh, that's a relief." Now he says, "It's time to go on to step two." And so, That's what we did, because that's what comes after one. And that was when I first started to get this idea that about the next right thing. Because when you finish a step, the next right thing is always, always, always start another step, right? And so, I started the second step. And it's in the beginning of the second step where I had to confront this idea that I mentioned earlier, that I had this kind of fake higher power that wasn't mine, And I started working out of the workbook, and I remember talking to my sponsor about this kind of fake higher power that I had. He laughed. He said, "You need to get rid of that." My sponsor was pretty importantly connected to the idea that my spiritual path is none of his business. And so he's like, "Go seek." He said, "I don't care how you seek, go seek and let me know if you find something." But he did make one suggestion, which was to start going to a meditation meeting. And I've talked about that before on hidden meetings. We had this meditation meeting on Thursday nights at 6:30. And if you were late, you couldn't get in because they shut locked the door because it's a meditation meeting. And so I started going to this meditation meeting. And at some point over the next, 3 months maybe, I had a spiritual experience. Now, in years past, I would describe it as, I found something. But the older I get, the more I kind of remember the depth of the experience, I realized that I didn't find anything. Something found me. And that higher power is with me today. So it was a pretty important thing that I did going to that meditation meeting. And I went to that meeting for quite a few years until it closed up. And that's when I first got introduced to meditation, was in the second step. I didn't, meditation was very difficult for me. I had, what we in America call ants in your pants. I couldn't sit still. I really couldn't sit still. That had served me reasonably well in active addiction, man. I'm always running, always busy, 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 got stuff to do. I seemed like I knew what I was doing. It's just a mask, one of many, many masks. One of the things that people do where I live is, in the second step, sometimes in the third step, sometimes in 7 or 11, they go on a spirit quest into the desert. And so that's what I did. I went to the important spiritual points in this place that I went. And I didn't have any burning bush moments or anything while I was doing it, but I felt like for the first time, maybe I actually could get a connection with that higher power that I had just recently been discovered with. I made a person, friend who had become a very good friend of mine during the course of the spirit quest. And I came back and I felt a little more comfortable with this idea of having a higher power. Because, when you think about it, you guys are telling me that I need to get a relation with something that at best exists outside of time and space, that there's no way to possibly understand it, and I'm supposed to, have a relationship with this. It scared the hell out of me. I was frightened of my higher power for a long time, I don't know if that was a good thing or not, but that's what I felt. I felt fright. So in any case, eventually I made it through the second step. And this idea of coming to believe. I struggled with it for a little while until I came to understand that I didn't have to believe anything particular to do the second step. I just had to believe that it was possible. That's all. I just had to believe that it was possible that there might be something greater than me in the world, and that whatever that thing was, that it might be able to help me. That's all. And once I understood the second step wasn't about, any particular entity or anything like that. It was just about me becoming open-minded and accepting the idea that there might be something greater than myself out there. It might be worth getting to know. And once I understood that, then it became a little easier for me to get with it. And so, and then we got to the part, the restoration of sanity part. Oh man. And for me, remember, this is my first set of steps. I'm new in the program. My whole life was insane. And I really struggled with this idea of restoration. How can I be restored to sanity when I have never been sane? How's that work? And I really struggled with that. And I remember someone telling me, what does this mean? They said, Keith, it means being restored to original condition. And that just really didn't help. And I think I had, it wasn't until I got into future steps that I really started to kind of get my mind around the restoration of the sanity part. And of course, now when I look back on it, I think, for me, the act of working the second step was in fact a restoration of sanity. Just working the step, just staying clean was restoration of sanity. And I finished my second step, and I'm still going to meetings regularly. Still, I guess maybe coming up on November, and I start the third step. Don't know about you guys, but I always get squirrely. I don't need more, but I used to get really squirrely around the holidays, and I can't remember. I think I spent that first Thanksgiving with someone from this group that I've been a part of. I haven't seen her in a long time, but it was a nice Thanksgiving. But I remember I felt like my skin was crawling. I mean, I was so uncomfortable in this person's house, and so uncomfortable with everybody there because I didn't really know them very well. I'd only been around for a few months. And but that's what happened. And I did my best to not lose my mind. And I remember that while I was working the third step, someone else took me to a Christmas party, and I remember just I had to go into another room, and finally the hostess, who's also in recovery, came in. She's a doctor, and she did some breathing exercises with me. And by the time we did that, I had calmed down, and that's one of the things that I experienced a lot throughout my recovery, is older, cleaner members saying, "Hey, let's try something together." Not just making a suggestion, but being willing to be with me as we practice that suggestion. And I really appreciate people with time up when they do that. It means a lot to me. So by the time I start the third step, I've got, I don't know, 5 months clean or something. So I'm starting to settle in a little bit into the fellowship. I know some people. I didn't really pick a home group yet, because it really wasn't my nature to be a quote be a part of, but there were numerous meetings where I was known by them, and I remember that Christmas there was a guy who always picked a couple of newcomers to come to his house for Christmas with a bunch of people with time up, and I was one of the chosen newcomers. And I remember I thought I was going to die being at this house. I hated it so much. But I thought, hey, I'm in a position of privilege here. I just can't be a fool. I got to try to, keep myself contained. And I managed to keep myself contained. And, and with the help of an old timer, his name was Rex. And he was a special guy. But at some point, with a lot of years clean, he went out that's what happens. And I needed to know that. I need to remember that it doesn't matter how much clean time I have. I could cop an attitude about you people today and go out and get loaded tomorrow or tonight. It's a daily program. It's just for today. And no one is safe from the disease of addiction. And that's a good place to be. And the third step, realizing that no one is safe from the disease of addiction. And so I got through the holidays, and I kept working my step. And I remember my sponsor really focusing on excuse me, making a decision part. They said, this is important. You have to decide this. Nobody can decide this for you. You have to decide. And here I am. I got 6 months clean. I'm working the third step. I'm going to this meditation meeting and I'm trying to figure out what this third step means to me. Because we all have, it's a very personal thing. And to understand the difference between my will and God's will, I had no clue. No clue what that meant. But all I knew is that, the pain, the emptiness I felt at the end of the first step wasn't so strong anymore. And the confusion and uncertainty that I felt after the second step was kind of dissipating too. And so I remember thinking, well, you know what? Maybe I should keep doing this. Maybe this is something I should keep doing. Maybe this is benefiting me in ways I don't quite understand. And, I think that's what it was. And eventually, though, I did do my third step. I did it with my sponsor out in nature. And I don't remember what it was like. I can visualize the event, but I have really kind of no memory of the thoughts and feelings that I might have had at the time. So I, really can't tell you about that. But what I do remember is that the people that were around me were, gave me lots of congratulations for completing my first third step. And lots of people with time up said, Keith, steps one, two, and three will keep you clean for a little while. But if you want freedom, if you really want to be free, you got to keep going. You got to do an inventory. And I remember thinking, no, I'm not doing that. Because there's this place, there's this, I don't know, there's this place, this physical place, this spiritual place, this emotional place in between three and four, where the decision to continue has to be made, where the decision to be, a member of Narcotics Anonymous must be finalized. You can't do a four step unless you've committed to being a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And so, I had to, make that decision again. Yes, I'm actually a member of Narcotics Anonymous, and that's going to give me the foundation that I need, to move forward and to go into an inventory. Because I had kind of flipped through it in the workbook. I'm like, there's no way I'm doing this. There's just no way I'm doing this. And for the user reasons. I mean, I may have completed the first three steps, but I still had lots of guilt and shame. Lots of shame, mostly shame, some guilt. And there was no way I was going to write down all the crap that I had done in my life. There's no way I'm writing that down. So I kind of had a conflict and an impasse within myself. I was pretty adamant that I wasn't going to do this. And I remember telling my sponsor that, well, let's just, take some time and see what happens. So for a while there, I was just going to meetings. That's really all I was doing. And I hadn't started my four step. Because the guilt and shame was overwhelming. Because by then, 6 months being clean, working three steps, that guilt and shame has the opportunity to come to the surface. And that's where I was at the end of the third step. I was hurting from guilt and shame. I was hurting from my own denial. I was hurting from my unwillingness, to keep going. And I thought seriously about leaving. I really did. And but fortunately, by accident, I had landed in two or three good groups, plus the meetings at the clubhouse. So there were lots of really strong addicts, people with time up, who were regularly carrying the message to me. And over time, there's a cumulative effect, And at some point, somebody said, "Yeah, Keith, doing a four step is an act of courage, an act of bravery, but it's one that we all have to do." You know, if you want freedom, and that's what people just kept saying to me, if you want freedom, you must do an inventory. If you want freedom. And I didn't know that I wanted freedom. I did, I just didn't know it. Because, you know, clean 6 months, I'm barely awake to my emotions, to my true emotions. And but eventually, you know, I started. And it was a really good thing that I did. Because right in that period, just before, as I was starting the four step, I met a woman in the program. Remember, I had, you know, at this point, I've got 9 months clean. She's got 90 days clean. And it seems like a really good idea to me to have a relationship. And I just, you know, wanted a hot NA girlfriend. I mean, who wouldn't, right? And I stayed clean through that relationship because I was working on a four step. And so I remember being so grateful that I got willing, you know, and that's, you know, in that period, that was the first time that someone taught me to pray for the willingness to be willing. And I do that every day now and have all these years. There's something powerful about that prayer, willingness to be willing. So, you know, so I went into this relationship and I went into my fourth step and, you know, and I just hoped that I'd be able to survive both of them. You know, and that's one of the things that happens at the end of the third step. You know, for the first time, you know, I felt, you know, that hope that you guys talk about, you know, and I think that, you know, I got a little better, you know, I felt a little closer to my higher power. I felt I didn't feel quite as frightened. And so things slowly change. And that's what happens when we work the 12 steps. There's change, but it's slow. It's incremental. It doesn't happen fast. It doesn't happen overnight. And sometimes it takes me even longer to notice that there's been any change. Because, you know, on any given Sunday, I am completely in my head. And my body is kind of an afterthought. You know, I have no idea what I'm really thinking and feeling. And but at the end of the third step, I remember feeling that hope. And that was the first time that I felt hope. And that reminded me, and I'm saying it now, it reminded me of the first thing that I had heard in the rooms. And I had just a few days clean. There was an addict, his name was Alex, he's passed now. But he described himself as a dope fiend of the hopeless variety. And I remember thinking, me too. You know, and that was the first time I really identified with something in Narcotics Anonymous. And there's been many identifications since. And I'm still not done identifying with that because I still get to identify with other things. And I'm so grateful for that. So anyway, that's my experience with my first version journey through one, two, and three. And I'm grateful to be asked, and I'm grateful to be a part of the Higna family, and I'll keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.